Holes Filled is a two-person attempt to create a perfect web of musical knowledge. We're on a constant hunt for records we forgot to listen to because when you're in a band, you listen to your practice tapes all day. It's so fucking stupid. You make practice tapes at practice and you listen to them like they're an album. You play them for your girlfriends. They're so patient. But we make an effort to find the hallmarks of genres and movements and whatever that we forgot to listen to because of that. So it should be a notable album or a genre defining album or just a really popular thing that we skipped. And we do a personal and a general. And the personal is like it relates to what we listen to, which is like metal or hardcore, like things that we're interested in, or just something that we focused on that I want to hear that. I want to hear that album. And the general is like, you know, someone of our age bracket or demographic or whatever should have probably heard this, and that could be anything from Tuvan throat singing masters Hun Hortu to Purple Haze. But it's not going to be Purple Haze because I'm not going to fucking listen to Purple Haze, and you could stuff that one straight up your ass. So this week, oh, by the way, this is usually a Taco Bell podcast. I feel, you know, I don't really know how this, like, I think people like the All Holes Filled concept, right?
Yeah,
our friends and our listeners like it. But it's a tough sell for me. Like, I don't know how to, I want to do some audience building. I want to like get some people into this, but I don't dare because I don't know how to say, yeah, well, every other week we just talk about records. Like, that's kind of shitty, but we're going to keep doing it because this is now the better podcast, in my opinion. Like, yeah. This is a far superior to the root product, but I'm not prepared to abandon the other one. It's like in Arrested Development when they keep the banana stand.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to mention is that last episode went over pretty well.
Good.
A lot of people wanted to talk to us about Japanese hardcore. Just people on the street stopped me, yep, and want to talk to me about Japanese hardcore now. I can't walk into a room and mention that I'm part of the Border Boss family of podcasts without someone, you know, wanting to tell me to listen to Gauze or whatever the hell. So there was a whole thing on Twitter with people telling me what to listen to. Most of it wasn't all my thing. There was a band I think called D-Clone or something like that. That was good. Did you listen to any of those links I threw up?
No, I haven't listened. No, I was doing stuff.
Some of the rest, they're your guys.
Yeah.
They're like wrestling guys.
Yeah. So one of them. Wait, I don't know if we want to let the cat out of the bag, but we've been talking about doing a like a compilation episode of All Holes Filled with guests.
Yeah.
And I think one of them might end up being, at least one of them, that was maybe even two of them when I was talking to you, might end up as guests on the show in the future.
I'm comfortable letting that cat out of the bag because we're gonna do it. That'll hold. Yeah. That puts our feet to the fire. We can announce it here that sometime in the next month or so we plan on releasing at least one, possibly more guest episodes where we're just gonna find people who will talk to us and they're gonna fill a hole on our dime and we're gonna ask them about it, and then we're gonna just stitch it together. It's going to be, you know, an all singing and all dancing spectacular.
It's like a various artists record. It's going to be a various artists podcast.
And they're just our friends. It's nobody. It's not like we're going out and finding like Joe Rogan or or anybody and asking him. Like, these are just people. It's just like our pals. So that should be really exciting for you to hear our private friends tell you which.
Well, that one dude, he's not my friend.
Oh no,
I know him a little through Twitter, but. Yeah, I wanted to, because that's my MO for podcasts. I only talk to the same like six people on podcasts because I just hate talking to strangers, and I don't think this is already burying our own podcast, but I don't think it sometimes makes for a good podcast to have two strangers talk to each other. So, so I try and avoid it, but we're gonna make this work.
I forgot to mention we're now on episode 41. We made it past episode 40. We had technical glitches during episode 40, so I didn't get to announce the glory of episode 40, which puts us halfway to episode 50. We're almost episode 50, which will be a banner year. Like that, to me, the fact that we made it 50 episodes on this podcast when it was basically dead in the water at episode 18, like not that long ago, it's a little bit of a tearjerker for me. I'm very happy that it's made it this far. But as you said, this is a new year. Baby New Year is in the house, and Mike had an idea.
So these records are loosely themed around birth. Yes. That's what you do around New Year's. So basically that means we picked a bunch of records with born in the title. I forgot this is not the podcast with Al, this is the podcast with Scott. But Scott had a Fredo pick and picked a Cold World album we'll talk about later. But there's a reason we chose that too. There's a little story behind it. So
right.
We'll get into that later. But the first up.
On Border Boss content, speaking of Al, Al's in Japan, right?
Yeah.
Or he you know, this will be almost 2 weeks from now or whatever. But as of right now, which is, January, 7th or something like that, 6th, yeah. Al is in Japan and he posted something that I think was some sort of sashimi or fugu. A plate. Was it fugu?
Yeah.
I thought he might have been a fugu restaurant and it was still twitching.
Yeah,
The food was twitching, and I think that's the idea. Is they whack it to pieces so fast that it's still alive when you eat it.
Well, the fugu is the death fish.
Yeah, it's the fish that can kill you.
Yeah.
and you also eat it while it's still its heart is still beating or whatever.
It's just murdered. Yes,
it's freshly murdered. Maybe not even murdered. It might not even be fully dead yet. So, what do you think, Mike? Would you eat? Like, I know you're into food adventure. Would you go for the octopus that comes back to life when you pour tea on it? Or any of those wild still like the lobster that's still staring at you and clacking its claws together when you eat the back half of it. Are you down for that?
I say I would all the time, but I've never really been presented with a chance. So I mean, I might puss out, but the closest I've come is I've had chances to eat balut, but I've had chances where I've been in the same room as balut. If somebody was like, "Hey, eat this," and I was on the spot, I'd probably do it. But since I wasn't on the spot, I didn't just set out and do it just to do it. I see that. I think I got this fire in my belly when I saw Old Boy like 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
And I was like, man, he ate a live octopus. That's fucking wild. And I haven't been presented with the chance to do a live octopus, but I think I would. I don't think I would do one as big as he did because that's ridiculous and I would be worried about dying. But I would definitely do the fugu, that's for sure.
Yeah, for me, it's probably not entirely on the menu, but the balut, I would, if life had checkpoints like a video game and you could just undo and say nope, I'd probably try all these things. I don't know if the balut, I look at it and I see that there's feathers and eyes and, and hair, and it's just, I don't know if I want that in my teeth, and I don't want to know if I'm, I'll be picking that out of my teeth. I don't know if that's how it works or not, but that's kind of the vibe that I get from it. Is it like it would be a long, hard road out of the balut if I didn't like the balut.
So that leads us to Leeway. Born
Naturally.
To Expire, yes. Yeah. This is Leeway, Born to Expire. It was released in 1989. I had legitimately never heard this record. I don't know if okay, so the first track is Rise and Fall. I think at the very least I've heard bands cover that intro. Unless I've heard bands rip that intro off, one or the other. But I've heard it in real life before. And I think I may have heard Mark the Squealer on like a compilation or something. But outside of that, never heard this band. I kind of was going into this expecting them to sound like Shitty Sick of It All. Because they are noted as New York hardcore pioneers, despite not being a hardcore band. But
yeah.
I'll get into that. And it seems, I don't know, I never had friends that listened to Leeway growing up. Even when we were in Albany in bands and we were like in the midst of people wanting to be the hardest of hardcore, knowing like all these old bands and caring about them. Because when I could say the same probably for Scott too, but where I grew up and when I grew up, no one gave a shit about old bands. No one listened to old hardcore bands.
Right.
That only started in like the late 90s to early 2000s is when people were like, oh, that band's the best. Like that shit did not exist when I grew up.
Yeah, no, even like the old, like when I was young, the older heads were more into being like weird and modern and like listening to grind and metal and being like bizarre. I don't know what the bug was, but they had all kind of abandoned the punk thing for a good 5-6 years and we're all doing, like crazy stuff. And it was, and then a couple years later, they were done with their crazy bands, and all of a sudden, all they were listening to was like DYS or something again. And I'm like, what happened? What happened here?
So yeah, so I didn't know anybody, and even when we were in that phase, none of my friends ever. They might have mentioned Leeway, but I've never heard anybody listen to them. I do know they are one of those bands that famously had, I don't know if they signed to a major label or what the deal was, but they released like a really bad album after this. Am I correct in that, Scott?
We can talk about that in some depth, but I will say no, that they released a really good album after this.
Yeah, because that one you would see, that would pop up in like FYE yeah. bargain bins and stuff.
It looks like
that.
It yeah. came out of the womb looking like a dollar bin yeah. record. It has a terrible album cover, terrible logo.
It would be right near like fucking MOD surfing for MOD. Like yeah. it would just be right. like it would be in that section. So I never heard them, and I thought they were shitty New York hardcore, like Sick of It All, because basically any time I saw this band mentioned was in like reviews where they would compare a band to Leeway, and it would always be like the type, like, I don't mind New York hardcore. I kind of like it. I like yeah. tough guy bands, shit like that. But they would always get compared to the kind of boring, more boring New York hardcore bands. And that's why I thought, they were more in like the vein of Sick of It All and Warzone. Not saying those bands are boring, but you know, when you're getting compared to those bands, I that's not the stuff that I'm looking for in hardcore, really. Yeah. So, I just always avoided them, and I was not really expecting what they sounded like, because mm-hmm. they are pretty much just a mid to late 80s thrash band.
Yeah.
Maybe a little slower, but outside of that, this is pretty much through and through like a thrash record. I would say the lyrics are a little more punk or hardcore leaning, and just from the little research I've done, it just seems like there's many bands and many hardcore scenes that don't fit the bill, but they just play hardcore shows, so they get labeled a hardcore band. And yeah. I think that's what happened. Like, I think this thrash metal band just played the CBGB shows and somehow got grandfathered into hardcore, because outside of the lyrics, you never know for this time period this was supposed to be a hardcore band. It's good. It's very good. I actually honestly regret not hearing this for my whole life, because I don't think this is the thing I could pick up today and be like, oh man, I really dig this record, because it's just yeah. like, you know, it's fucking old. There's hundreds of records that sound like this now. The nitpicks I have is the vocals are very much thrash, mid-80s thrash vocals, mm-hmm. And that's not my favorite type of vocals. Although I will say it's kind of weird, because the first couple tracks, the vocals are very, very clean, and it seems like every successive track, he backs up a little more away from the microphone and gets like a little more reverb on his voice. I don't know if that was on purpose or what, but so the first couple tracks are a little too clean for me, but then that drops. And I will say he has that disease where, I mean, again, he's probably I don't know if this dude was a teenager at the time, but you know, he's young, so I'm not gonna fucking tear down his lyrics or anything, but he's one of those people that went to the school of thinking like every single one of your lyrics had a rhyme. And this guy is not a very good rhymer, so that kind of suffers there. But again, it's like a little thing, and you know, and there's even like the joke thrash song on here with the Seinfeld bass and like the sort of rapping mm-hmm. vocals, the Catholic schoolgirl song. Yep. But you know, outside of that song and outside of the lyrics, this is like a pretty thrashing record, man. This is pretty fucking good. It's unfortunate I avoided all these bands that would always get mentioned being influenced by Leeway, because I you know, now looking back, I assume that just meant they sounded like thrash, I guess. Yeah. And that was just a hardcore person's only frame of reference for thrash music was Leeway. But yeah, I mean, I don't have much else to say about outside of that. I think this is a really great record. If I heard this when I was 16, I'm pretty sure I would have liked it, because I liked MOD when I was 16. I did sway more on the end of jokey music back then, and yeah. this, there's no real jokes. I don't think I would have liked that Catholic girl song when I was 16. I would hope I would not, because I don't think that I would even found that funny when I was that age and had the fucking stupid bass and everything else. But yeah, I mean, also, oh, that's one thing I forgot to point out. Is this where Snitches Get Stitches came from? Was he the first guy to say Snitches Get Stitches?
First place I ever heard it, but I mean, yeah. you know, am I particularly street? No.
Yeah. And what a legacy to have, to be the first person to coin the phrase "snitches get stitches." That's pretty cool. But I think the cover's great. This is a great album. I'm very sad I missed out on it. I don't think it's something I could get away with listening now, because it is kind of dated sounding, but it's really great. And if you were like me and just always avoided Leeway because basically everybody's lying about listening to them. Most people are, I think. I think most people have been lying about listening to Leeway. Yeah. You should listen to them, because it's a pretty good record.
There's some bullet points that we... First of all, I agree 1,000% on almost everything you said. This is a thrash band. They're definitely just... They were just in the place and time that they were playing with other bands, the hardcore bands, so they just got... They just became New York hardcore. They're not. I mean, I don't get... There's no... I guess they mean there's some mid-paced mosh stuff. It doesn't matter. Like, everybody was doing that. Anthrax, Nuclear Assault. Like, all the bands that were out were doing, you know, some slamming pit parts at this point. It was normal to have mosh parts in thrash. It was normal to have, you know, political lyrics in thrash by then. It was normal to do all this stuff. So they're just... I don't even think that they would have argued it. They were just like, oh, yeah, you know, we were playing these shows.
Yeah, there's something in their Wikipedia that says... And you know, at the end, they kind of regretted bringing that element of like suburban metalheads to hardcore shows. But yeah, they doesn't say the origins of why they played these shows though. So who knows?
The reason that I knew Leeway, because I was not a hardcore dude at this time, but I knew Leeway because when the next album, I can't think what it's called,
Desperate Measures.
When Desperate Measures came out, we had one good the Jesuit college. In town, like the actual, like the Christian college in town, Siena, had a radio station that played the High Voltage Zone at midnight, 88.3, the High Voltage Zone, played metal, like real metal. That's where you'd turn it on and they could be playing like Creator, Slayer, whatever. They'd be playing death metal, thrash metal. They lean more towards thrash, but they played a lot of metalcore. They played Mucky Pup all the time. The Jokies, they played like Batman and like the Jokey songs. They just, because that's what they were doing. They're doing like a, you know, morning zoo thing, but it's midnight. So they would play, you know, kind of jokey thrash songs in between. But they would play tons of songs off of Desperate Measures. And it's really odd because if you listen to that album, some of it sounds kind of like this one. Some of it's got the, you know, the metal, the crossover metal thing. Some of it is like rappy, rap core, rap hardcore, when there was no such thing at the time. I don't know if I'm not saying they invented it, but I was really mad about that. I was so ferociously mad because they led with the song Stand For. The song Stand For sounds like it could be the band Triumph, like the 70s, 80s arena rock band Triumph. It's like, it sounds like Magic Power by the band Triumph. Google the song Magic Power. That's what this song sounds like. It's like a, you know, an arena rock song or something like that. And it's really like exciting and fun. And then they played the song Kingpin, which opens with like the Flintstones commercial rap.
Oh,
my name is Fruity Pebbles, and I'm here to say
my name is Barney, and I'm here to say yeah.
They do that on some of the songs on that album, and it's I think it's in character, like it's meant to be like a character in the song is from the streets or whatever, so he raps, I guess, but it's pretty bad. But this, you know, so this album, just to go back to this album is very, very good. It's very heavy for the time. It's amazing. Amazing to think that this is 87 for the stuff that they do on this album. It's like it has all the parts that Prong made famous a few years later, like dan 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 dan, you know, like those kind of like cool groovy like parts or whatever, those weird groovy metal parts. They were doing that. They were doing, you know, just all this like mixture of regular thrash and like sort of crossover hardcore thrash. Excuse me. They recorded in 87, and it's really good sounding, like the guitars, the drums, the bass, everything is mixed really well, and it's just amazing. Because at this, I once upon a time I decided to make MySpace friends with the guy from the band Dead Horse, who I don't get to talk about as often as I'd like to, because that there's an album called Peaceful Death and Pretty Flowers. It's one of my favorite albums in the world, and I don't think it gets a whole lot of press. It's like an awesomely weird and heavy and good, like early 90s thrash album, but it's really heavy, and it's like the guitars are awesome, and it's at a time when people were using like pedals that they sound like, you know, they sound like a JPEG. Sounds like you're listening to a JPEG on the radio. And so you listen to this, and it's the same thing. It's like, wow, how did they get this sound? And it's because they were just using like regular, like they were using the stuff that everyone else had sold to buy digital equipment at this time. So it stands out. It's like, it's not like anything else that was out at the time. Like even the really, if you listen, back to the name brand bands that you're thinking of in your head, you're thinking like Anthrax and Testament and like all those, you know, the Bay Area thrash bands, all sorts of stuff. Listen back to their good albums. They're bad. They're good music, but they're badly mixed or something stands out. One of my favorite albums is, Testament, Practice What You Preach. It sounds like someone's playing a rubber band stretched over an oatmeal, container on the bass. Anthrax, State of Euphoria. Listen to that album. The bass drums actually sounds like someone's hitting a timpani nonstop. Like the whole album is double bass and it sounds like someone's playing it on a timpani. It's awful. This album is perfect. And I don't even know who they, I don't know if they went to Don Fury. I didn't really read about it. I don't know who did it, but whoever did it nailed it. They're the best 80s thrash metal producer in the world. And it was for this thing that doesn't even really claim to be thrash metal entirely, but to me it is. So I dig it. Also, they in 87, I think that they predicted or predated everybody else who did like a goofy funk thrash song. Because after this, everybody did it. Sacred Reich, Nuclear Assault, all these bands would put like a goofy, they would be like a totally serious album, a totally fine, like serious thrash album, paying its taxes, going to work every day. And then they just threw like a funk metal song into it, with Sacred Reich being the worst. And DM me, I'll talk to you all about Sacred Reich's funk metal song. It's one of my favorite topics. So the fact that they predicted that and they put just in the middle of their serious thrash album, they just threw in a goofy song with like rapping and snapping and slap bassing. Pretty incredible. Pretty ahead of the curve, I guess. Mm-hmm. Cause this was recorded in 87. It was released in 89, but it was recorded in 87. So yeah, like I knew about them. This wasn't the album for me at the time because I was listening to the other one because that's the one that was getting played on the high voltage song. But I think this is impressive. And I think even just the intro riff, like the intro riff is so heavy and slamming and there's nothing like it. I'm not that up on my, cross, like this era's crossover. But if someone can point to me some stuff that's as like slamming and heavy as this.
Like I said, I like it a lot, but it's just, I mean, I can listen to it in my own time, but. I guess I'm so old and jaded now. It's hard to look back at something you missed that's, kind of stuck. And this isn't like a, this doesn't transcend its genre, basically. This is its genre, even though it's labeled wrong as a hardcore record. But it's, it is a thrash record. And I even the stuff I like from that period, it's tough for me to listen to now, I think.
I would agree with you that I felt like I wasn't hearing about this album. And I guess, or this band for a while, and then all of a sudden I was. And I guess they got back together in 2006 and went on some tours. If I had a time machine and could prove this, I would say that probably around 2006 was all of a sudden when all these young people were all like, oh, Leeway, dude. Leeway. Yeah. And, now it's normal because now everyone just unearths all the old New York hardcore and is super all about it, whether it was good or bad. But when we were just 10, 15 years ago, to have, we'll say 12 years ago, 2006, to have people all of us, like people that you knew who had no interest in thrash metal, no interest in metal in general, all of a sudden being like, oh, fucking Leeway, man. Leeway's my shit. Like, I love Leeway. Really? I've never heard you say Leeway before. So I would say that probably there's something to do with that. Like, their reunion, I think, probably sparked a renewed interest.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want anybody coming at me saying, oh, how did you never hear this band? Well, because everybody's been lying about listening to them. That's how I've never heard them.
You're a lying sack of shit. So my album was, and this is let's just continue on a desperate downward path of being old men. My album was Lana Del Rey, Born to Die. And it's because, I don't know about you, but I don't really keep up with pop, regular pop right now. I do my best to try and keep up with some metal. I don't really, I listen to some hardcore here and there. Like, I listen to some weird rap. I listen to some weird music here and there. But I don't know, like, if you talk to me about any of the people that are, in Rolling Stone magazine right now, the weird part of Rolling Stone magazine, I don't know any of them. I don't know what they're up to. I don't know what they sound like. And to be a real sack of shit, I'll tell you that when it's a lady, I assume they all kind of sound like one of two things. Like that they either sound like the Twin Peaksy guitar, like Mazzy Star, kind of like, like drugged out, laid back, trippy, singing music, or that it's like really glitzy, crazy synthy pop stuff, like, I don't know, Churches or Ellie Goulding or something.
Sia.
Yes, Sia. Like, I mean, I don't know what she sounds like. I don't know. it's not for any other reason other than that I just don't know who any of these people are. I don't really listen to their music. And if it's really, really crazy pop, or if it's weird pop, or if it's indie that is just really famous, I have no idea. So Lana Del Rey, I kind of had this vibe that she might be something a little bit off the beaten path, even though she's a big name and well known. And I figured I'd check this out and all of a sudden become an expert in post 2005 pop music. Right on the spot. I think everybody my age and my style, everybody of my style probably did the same thing, where they tried to branch off from metal at some point. And my thing was, I really got into Bjork and Stereolab when I was like, I don't know, 18, 17, something like that. And then I wanted everything that sounded like that. And I chased it super hard. If there was like a lady singing in front of electronic music, I wanted to hear that. Like, I have so many CDs behind me right now, just a stack, probably all, like, I could have, some of this went on my college loan, so I got my wages garnished in, the early 2000s because of the CDs behind me. So, for me, like, something like this probably would have been okay back then, which is, like, she's sort of singing a little weird, but not that weird, and then the music is all really, like, where you can't mentally dissect any of the instruments. Like, can you tell what's going on in this music?
I can tell the sampled, like, I can tell the mild hip-hop influence, where there's like a very famous breakbeat they use, and there's, yeah, like, a few... It's, like, it's basically, like, they had some kind of, like, hip-hop sampler package that you got, like, introductory, right, with the keyboard, and they were just pressing those buttons randomly. But outside of that, yeah, it's just kind of that, like, airy music.
Yeah, you could tell, like, right, so they put very obvious drums over very... difficult to discern music, so it just sounds like strings and synths and atmosphere and shimmer, and it's all like that, and it's all like that nonstop. This this thing never stops being melodramatic, cinematic. It's a tough one. I'm still not sure how I feel about this album. There's things I really disliked. I don't like that half the songs are written like club jams. Like, I'm out here drinking and fucking, and I'm like smoking and fuck you. Like, she swears somewhere here and there just to let you know that even though this sounds really formal and really elegant, that she's, I guess, a badass or something like that. That stuff I could take a pass on. The rest of it is just so even and so similar. Like, you could drop the needle anywhere on this album and it's all either as good or bad as you like it. There's not a song in here that is worse than any other song, really, sonically. It's just pretty cool. This album is definitely like a laser beam of whatever this is. Everything is just about as good as everything else. But I don't know. So the only thing that I'll say is that there's a song called like Summertime Sadness at the end. It's a little bit, the melody's a little bit more new wavy, and it also does the thing where this song does it in certain parts, the beat doubles. So that means they have something in common with Biohazard and Hatebreed, that they do the Biohazard thing where it goes do do ta do 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 ta do do ta do ta do, like where it does the punishment pickup. So that's pretty sick. Other than that, yeah, like this is just it's kind of like too atmospheric and too mushy. And also, to be honest, these vocals could be someone doing a rap cover with ukulele on YouTube. And that's no bueno for me. Like, I don't really dig that sound. Like, she's very, like, 2000s white girl. She does all the inflections that you can probably think of in your head. And, I think she's in control of them better than average. Like, she's a master of whatever this voice is, and she does a good job of it. And if you watch a couple of live videos, I just threw a few up there. She seems to pull it off. The cover is cool. I think the cover's neat. It looks almost like, a still from a weird, like a Coen Brothers movie or something like that. Like a weird movie where, the well put together girl in town is a murderer or something like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. It's called Born to Die. That's super cool. A lot of suicide and death talk on this album. I'm way into that. But what did you think of it, Mike?
I'm with Scott when it comes to pop music. There's at least two levels of pop music. Scott kind of mentioned the Mazzy Star style, which is the type of pop music that ends up on on a Saturday Night Live, and yeah. I'm sitting there going, who the fuck is this? And I fast forward it. I never hear from them again, usually, because it's usually some flash in the pan. But Lana Del Rey is in that upper echelon of the five people that you hear on the radio once an hour. Mm-hmm. And that's it's the type of music where you'll see like mainstream publications and websites say, this is a shitty year for music, and it's only because Lana Del Rey and Drake did not release an album this year. It's just like stuff like that. Like, they control the music industry right now. And furthermore than that, they don't even control it. The 20 Swedish people that write all of these people's songs are the people that really control the music industry.
Right.
So I find, like, this is going to be a diatribe, but basically I find it kind of hard to even either like criticize or even talk about pop music, because it's such a fake thing.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's not, it does its job. It's like modern pop music, at least. I think, you know, earlier pop music, it's a little more interesting. It's a little less clinical and made by a factory, I think. Not completely 100%, but it had a little more freedom, I would say. But now it's like, you know, it's like this factory. And I think people like me and Scott, we can appreciate pop music when we hear it. And I think I like kind of relate that to how we do a podcast about Taco Bell. We like Taco Bell, but we know what it is. Yeah. And I kind of think the people who are like fans of pop music, like that's their main shit, they are the type of people who not only like Taco Bell, but they think it's the greatest Mexican food in the world. And I would think there's an even a level beyond that. The people who are like really concerned that Ariana Grande broke up with the guy from Saturday Night Live and right. they want to know who she's dating yet. Those are people that not only love pizza or not only love Taco Bell and think Taco Bell is the best Mexican food, they actually think a Mexican family is making the Taco Bell for them, because they're so fooled by this fucking charade. Like I said, that is basically the seeds are 20 Swedish people in Sweden writing these songs and just putting them on a conveyor belt. So that's the reason I never listened to Lana Del Rey. Up until about, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I don't even know was that, she had an album called Ultraviolence, and I mixed it up with this one, because I when Scott chose this, I was like, oh, I heard that record. But I actually heard her record after this, which is Ultraviolence, and I heard that, and it's, I'm not going to say it's less poppy than this, but there is very obvious signs, like Scott said, like songs in the club, like the very vague but unthreatening hip-hop influence that's on this record. Yep. Like, there's not a lot of that on Ultraviolence. Ultraviolence sounds more like Lana Del Rey. I'm probably off on at least one of these comparisons, but she kind of reminds me of a female version of Chris Isaac. And and also, is it Lana Miles, the black velvet and a navy boy smile?
Yes.
I think it's Lana Miles is her name, something like that. But she kind of reminds me of like a cross between that type of 80s and 90s female pop, or like female rock pop vocalist, and Chris Isaacs. And I think her Ultraviolence record is more on that wavelength of not so obvious pop music. So when I first heard that, I was like, really? This is like the person who's like kind of crossing over beyond pop into like people I know who like her. And I'm like, oh, maybe it's like the lyrics are deep or whatever. So, you know, I listened to it once, I forgot about. But this record, I could see this is very, very obvious. You know, they worked really hard on this record to make sure every single one of these songs could be a single that could be on the radio for the next year or two after it came out. And I don't blame them for that. And I think it's pretty good. Like, I think a lot of this is pretty catchy, and it's catchy in a way that's not, you don't feel embarrassed about it, really. Mm-hmm. Like, I like a lot of Katy Perry singles. I think she's probably the top for me when it comes to writing pop music. Not lately, but, you know, when she was at her peak, I was just like, this is, you know, this is pretty great. But you still, if you say that out loud and you're not a person who regularly listens to pop music, people might be like, well, what the fuck are you talking about? Why do you listen to that? And it's just like, that's a good pop song. This, I think that's what Lana Del Rey's crossover appeal is. It's so, like, vague, I guess. Like, the music is so vague.
Yeah.
You can be from any walk of life and listen to it and not feel weird about it. And I do think Ultraviolence, she's kind of like, she got to do more of her own thing and more of her own style before she was signed to a major label by having a mysterious viral video pop up, which is how big record labels kind of introduce their soon to be artists now, is pretend that they had this viral video that they had nothing to do with somehow, that just got millions and millions of hits. So yeah, she has a great voice. She's from upstate New York. She's from Lake Placid, which is a very depressing place if you've ever been there. It's it's definitely
a place to be for one day. One day is great. Yeah. 2 days is suicide.
It's they used to do the Winter Olympics back there, I think, before any of us were born. Or maybe in the 80s too, it's actually. Yeah, and then it stopped and there's nothing there anymore. It's
just the graphics are still up. Like, so there's still 80s graphics for everything that you
Yeah. So it's a very depressing place. So I could, you know, I could see her point of view. So yeah, this is a great record, but it's pop music, so it's, you know, it's whatever. It's good for what it is. I would put this above I've never heard Taylor Swift, but I assume I would like this more than Taylor Swift. But you know, I can see what people bit down on, because this does appeal to so many directions of people that I could see how this kind of blew up.
There's a, I don't like this movie and I don't like this comparison, but I'm going to do it anyway. There's the movie High Fidelity has a scene where the dude goes, I'm going to sell 3 CDs right now. And he puts on a Beta Band record and it's like just really smooth and it's odd, but still not offensive. And this is the same way. Like you could put the, like someone could put this album on in a record store in the old days and they would sell the record on the spot.
Yeah.
Cause it's just like inviting and interesting, but not that challenging. And I think that that's the whole thing. But you know what I do think about this is that when I listen to this, like this is a, I don't know if this album is the big one, but she has albums that are this big. She has albums that are really big. She's a big name. She's like, you know, a celebrity. And this album is still odd. This is still a strange album. Like this isn't Katy Perry in any way.
No.
This is definitely odder than that. And you know, the stuff that's really popular right now, it's taken for granted by the audience because that's what you do when you're young. Like you just listen to what's around you and you absorb it and you sort of take it for granted. What is playing right now to everybody under the sun is very weird music. The rap that's out now is very weird. The beats, the synths, like the broken aesthetic, like, and especially like the YouTube rappers and stuff like that, like Takeshi 69 or whatever, just shouting over weird beats. Or the thing that like, I was talking about this on the internet not that long ago. That song, the song that became a TikTok meme, where like a little Sailor Moon girl is singing this thing about Mia Khalifa. It's bad, and it's like sort of rap, sort of sing-songy garbage pop. It's apocalyptic. Like this is apocalyptic music. Listen to that. Find Mia Khalifa. Like just track that down. There's a diss track.
You're gonna find a lot of ghoul pictures too.
Find a lot of ghoul pictures because she was a porn star. Pictures.
Yeah.
But what happened was that these young people, they're like in their early 20s. They just wrote a diss track about her. I don't think that they had any connection to her. So this is basically like the musical version of like happy slapping or the punching game or whatever you call that stuff where people are like the myth where people are just getting punched in the city.
Yeah.
They just did that. They just picked the porn star that they didn't like for whatever reason, wrote this really, really hard diss track. Just
I Love Friday is the name of the
I
band.
Love Friday. And it's not good. Like the guy just sings through auto tune. He's like, you suck dick for money and you're trying to get an expensive car because you suck dick and whatever. It's of course she's a porn star. What's the diss here? But it's a terrible song, but it's so weird. It's really kind of well produced and bizarre and synthy and like trippy. And to me, the fact that they just took a name out of the phone book and wrote a really elaborate diss track and then got super famous with it. That's like the end times. Like it's, you check it out. It's a really weird song.
That stuff like that is why I don't understand how people still fall for this pop music shit and people really buying into, you know, Lana Del Rey waking up one day and somehow enchanting the world with her voice.
Yeah.
And that they don't see, like, I don't know how to this day and age, you can't see how it's just like a huge machine when you do have that power to write some kind of weird song that just gets popular organically, basically.
Yeah. Just on your own, you can actually just open up Fruity Loops or whatever and make a really bizarre song and then make a video where you show your penis or something like that and you'll get a, yeah. And it'll work for you. That's basically what Death Grips did.
Yeah,
they put their dick on
much.
An album cover and they got really weird music into the mainstream. Yeah. So yeah, I mean that like to me that I think that that's wonderful and dark at the same time. But like as someone who likes bizarre music, it's almost like I wish people who are into it could appreciate how weird it is. I don't think they do. I don't think they care. It's just like what they like. It's just their music. I'm like, man, I wish you really knew how bizarre your music is.
Yeah. Speaking of bizarre music, my general pick is a little known album, Cult Following, called Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. This was released in 1984.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1984. I obviously have heard Bruce Springsteen before, but I am a habitual Bruce Springsteen hater. And I've hated him for many years. And I'll get to that, why I hate him, because it's not really the music. But I've hated him for many, many years, but I've never really sat down and listened to Born in the USA in its entirety. And pretty much my entire life, like when I was a little kid, that was the hottest shit on the streets. Besides Michael Jackson, Thriller, and like Madonna, Bruce Springsteen was, you know, in the top three probably, and at least older people I knew. I know like there's multiple people that my mom, like my mom's friends had the Bruce Springsteen poster in like their house somewhere. Like it was a pretty fucking big deal when I was a kid. So this album, like I said, I never really listened to it in its entirety. And, you know, for the most part, I've heard most of these songs before because they're all, I think there's like six or seven singles on this and it's only like 10 or 12 tracks, I think. So that's, half or more than the half of this record is a hit single.
Yep.
So yeah, sitting down listening to it, I'm going to say right away, listening to it like on a technical level, this is a very amazing record, I think. This is just Bruce Springsteen is a very, very good songwriter. He really knows how to paint a picture with his words. As cliché as that is to say, he is incredibly good at it. The music on here, that's another thing we forgot to mention about Lana Del Rey. That album, the Born to Die album, has four different versions on Spotify already. This album is right. 5 years old. It has four separate versions. Yeah. This Born in the USA.
With different album cover art for some of them, too.
Yeah. This is Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen. This album sounded so good in 1984. There is, like, one remaster in its history, and it's just, like, a weird, like, vinyl remaster. It's not like they never went back and had to remaster anything on this actual album because it sounds so fucking good. It sounds so good. It's kind of, like, music that... Like, it's its own genre, basically. Like, it's kind of just, like, I would say, like, northeastern country music or something. Because it's, like, it has, like, country tones. And it has, like, blues tones. But it's being played by these weird fucking New Jersey dudes. And it has, like, you know, some rock to it. And I'm sure Scott will note it, but Bruce Springsteen kind of popularized that throaty singing style. And it all just works, man. Like, on a technical level, this album is... flawless. It has maybe one of the catchiest, moodiest songs about pedophilia, I'm on Fire, which seems real sketchy. And it's just like, it's hit after hit on this record. Is that enough for me to like Bruce Springsteen? Probably not, because my big hang up with Bruce Springsteen, and now I have a podcast so I can talk about it.
Give it to him.
Yeah.
Let him have it.
Basically, he's been faking the funk for super long. This record came out in 1984. As far as me knowing Bruce Springsteen, this was my introduction to him. But, you know, as you grow older, you realize he had fucking eight or nine records before this. He was basically a rock star, rock artist since the early to mid 70s. He basically, he got signed to Columbia in 1972. He didn't really hit big until 1975. And by then, in 1975, he was also writing songs for other big artists. And that's where you really make money. So. And you know, before that, 1964 is when he was in a band. So basically he did the thing when you're in a band, I think 8 to 10 years is a good amount of struggling to do before you hit big. That's pretty much everybody's road if you hit big.
Yep.
And you know, then he hits big. So that's basically 20 years of his life has been taken, dedicated to music since he was 18 years old. He was 30 something when Born in the USA came out, 35, 34, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when you're pretty much at your peak when it comes to creativity and stuff like that. So it all lines up, and that's great and all, but there's a lot of songs on not only this record, but his record before this, and I assume many, many records after this, about being a working man, just getting your hands dirty.
Yeah.
And, you know, just going down to fucking whatever county in South Carolina to work on the oil rigs or whatever the fuck they're talking about in that song. And there's a lot of that. And it's really well written. Like he really paints a picture, but this man has not gotten his hands dirty in 20 years at this point. He's been loaded for 10 years. At this point, like fucking rich to live for the rest of his life to never think about any oil rigs ever again in his fucking life. He could fucking retire at this point.
He gets to drive a Tesla, so he doesn't need an oil rig.
And, you know, it's cool that he, at that point, he's still writing. Like, he wrote this fucking amazing album that's his biggest known hit.
Yeah.
And it will be till the day he dies. I don't know, that Philadelphia song's pretty big too, though. So, but either way, that's kind of just, that's disingenuous to me. That's like, that seems kind of shitty to be, it's not really glorifying. See, that's a problem I have, and I think people would argue with me with, is that it's not technically glorifying it. Like,
right.
The best example I could think of is that NWA came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time you didn't know this, but Ice Cube mostly wrote the whole Straight Outta Compton record lyrically. He wrote the most of the lyrics. Ice Cube did not grow up in Compton. He grew up, but you know, he went to like a nice school. He was kind of like their friend that you know was good at writing. So he wrote all the lyrics. But I could believe that Ice Cube knew these guys, so he could write those lyrics better. I could also believe Bruce Springsteen knows people who works on oil rigs because he's Bruce Springsteen. He could probably hire one to hang out with him for a day. Yeah. And, you know,
do like some Anderson Cooper stuff, just show up and like ask questions or whatever.
So, you know, that's fine. But the big difference is Ice Cube wrote that record coming out of high school. He was like probably 18 or 19 years old. If somebody told me, was like, oh, you know, like a 35-year-old man wrote that NWA record who had been rich for 20 years beforehand, I'd be like, huh. That's kind of weird to be writing Fuck the Police and being like an established rich person, because I don't think you have that anger inside of you. So basically what I'm getting at is I guess on one end of the stick, you can look at it as he's such a good writer that he could pretend that he's ever had to drive his girlfriend to work. Like, that's like one of the lyrics of the song. That has never happened. Bruce Springsteen has never driven any. And, you know, to his credit, I think he does stuff. Like, he's not a dickhead with his money. He's not.
Right.
Like rumored, like Bono bought like a fucking first class plane ticket for his hat once. I don't think he does that. I will say though, if you love the Working Man so much, I still think it's like $300 to see Bruce Springsteen.
I think
you're at the point in your career where you could prevent that if you were really Bruce Springsteen. So you know, there's stuff like that. It's just like, okay, I think you still like money a little too, but on a technical level, I think this record's great. And like I said, do you think that's a fair assumption, Scott? Do you think that he shouldn't be glorifying or like kind of like wishing he was a working man when you're like fucking loaded?
I think like on a couple of these songs, he's kind of like maybe intervening. He's saying like, hey, man, you know, like it's tough for these people, you know, like he's putting his hand on the chest of his fellow millionaires and saying, hey, guys, yeah. It's tough for these people.
I mean, it's cool in a way that he wrote these songs for the, like, you know, these are working man's anthems he's writing here. And that's cool. But once you get, I guess I look too deep into things, just like my pop music analogies. But yeah, it's just like once you look into it and you're like, this is like a rich millionaire. This isn't like, you know, a lot of rap music. It kind of starts off with a dude writing a very hungry album where it's like a lot of violence and like gunplay and stuff like that. And he sounds very hungry. And then he gets rich and then he starts writing about how rich he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that never happened to Bruce Springsteen.
No,
he's just,
it can't. There's no analog for that with rock.
Like when I was reading his Wikipedia to make sure I wasn't bullshitting, it did say right after this he released Tunnel of Love, which I guess was all like love songs, and it kind of bombed.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking maybe he didn't want to do this for his whole career, but he was like, well, I think this is my thing now. Like, yeah, I got to do this. But I'm torn. I guess I can understand why all my friends and people I know like Bruce Springsteen. He is very good at, like, his whole band. They're very, very, I think there's multiple saxophone solos on this record. So the fact that you can have a classic record that has multiple saxophone solos on it is just like amazing to me. There's just like shit like that. Like it's like he created his own genre and just perfected it overnight, basically. And that's amazing. But like I said, it's just the content kind of rubs me the wrong way. So I can never fully like Bruce Springsteen, but now I do understand why people like him. So I guess mission accomplished for me when it comes to this record.
Yeah. Here's the first catastrophically large all holes filled error. Take notes, everybody. I thought you listened to Born to Run.
Oh God. Oh my God. No.
It's a Born album. It fits the format, and it's a better album. It's like a, you know, that's it. That's it. The album people would tell you to listen to by Bruce.
See, that's the thing. I asked like Doan, and I asked, I think my girlfriend. I might have asked a couple other people, but I was between this, Nebraska, and Born to Run. And then I was like, I guess if I'm going to do one, I might as well do Born in the USA, because that's like the big one that at least everybody has heard.
Born in the USA is cool because it was like before he even finished recording the album, you know, conservative Republicans were misusing the title track.
Yeah.
Like, oh, shit, this is my anthem. And they start.
And I forgot to mention that song is kind of like the prequel to Rambo. If you like listen to it, it's like leading up to the movie Rambo. And that's great.
Yeah, it is not something that should be used at the kind of rallies it gets used at right now.
No.
Like, the lyrics are very clear. They're very intelligible. You can very easily listen to that song and parse that it is not out there trying to, like, get people to vote Republican. It's that's not the deal with that song. I am with you that this is almost so, like I said, I listened to Born to Run, and I've listened to this album too, so I'm familiar with both. But I'll just take the career as a gestalt. I'll do the whole thing, because I always want someone to talk to me about this. I don't even know how to phrase it, because I don't have a good foundation for this. But what do you call this genre? How do you start this band? How do you start a band with 15 people in it? Like, how do you, you know, like I think that what it's trying to be, like this album, not as much as the one that the other one, Born to Run or whatever, but that this is sort of supposed to be R&B the way R&B used to be before it met Jodeci and SWV and stuff. Like, old R&B, like the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
Would be that your band would, you wouldn't know what instrument was playing what, and there'd be a horn section, there'd be like a piano player, and there'd be all these other guitars doing things, and you can't really even pick apart which instrument is doing what. And that's kind of what Bruce Springsteen's music is. There's just a bunch of people on stage, a bunch of spotlights. It takes a stage the size of like a small venue just to hold the band. And all the extra singers and all the backup vocalists and all the other people that are on there. And to take it to the other album for a second, if you actually listen to Born to Run, every single song has a Glockenspiel going nuts on it, like a bells. So you know all those songs, they're hits. You know, Born to Run, all those songs, they're hits. If you've never really paid attention, because it's just like steakhouse background, you know, music, it's like rock radio nonsense. Listen to it. Every song has a ting. Ting ting ting, ting like these bells playing. It has to be the only time in history that a Glockenspiel player was getting laid, because he's on every single song on some of these albums. So he had to have been a member, or somebody was doing this on purpose. Someone was drawing a paycheck to put that bell over everything. This kind of like edgeless genre of just, you know, quote, that just rock. It's just kind of like rock, R&B, soul, rock, country, roots, Americana rock, or whatever. Is real weird to me. And I would love to know, like, when you start out, is it just guitar, bass, and drums, and you just keep adding people? Or do you actually start out like auditioning? I need 30 people to growl over.
I guess when I was reading his Wikipedia, the most of his band, he was kind of putting together, he got the nickname The Boss from being, I guess, you know, basically the band boss, basically.
Right.
And he was in like 800,000 bands when he was starting out. So I guess he was just like piecing together the best band. So these are all people he's worked with, I guess, in the past that he kind of pieced together. So he definitely had a vision for a long time.
Well, his sax player is the guy, Clarence Clemons. He's the big man. He gets dropped in lyrics and stuff like that. So that's why there's always awesome sax parts. You know, some of his big hits have sections in the middle that are just there for the sax player to show you how good he is. Not in a solo. You know, he has a lot of songs that are almost like Domino by Van Morrison, where the song just stops and they go, here's a cool idea we had, you know, like, you know, and they just play like some kind of like, you know, some kind of like exciting, like almost like a centerpiece that has nothing to do with the rest of the song. The song's just rock, rock, rock. And then all of a sudden it takes a break in the middle and there'll be this epic, you know, like Rosalita from one of his other albums has a part like that, where it just has a part in the middle where they just, here's a completely different idea we have for a really cool instrumental that we couldn't think of any words for. So we just tucked it into this other song. I kind of miss that, because I think that used to happen more. Like Layla by Eric Clapton, the end of Layla, the Goodfellas part, has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the song. It's just an idea that he had, like an epic, you know, soundtracky idea he had. He's like, I'm just going to stick it on Layla. I don't think people really do that much anymore. I don't think there's any call for it. I don't think there's any format for it, but it's not really where pop and rock is right now. But having Bruce Springsteen still did it up to a certain point where he would just go nuts. He'd say like, I really want this to be like I want this to be a journey. I want there to be another song in the middle of my song at all times. Glory Days, I think is like Glory Days is another one. That's like a sort of a misinterpreted song or whatever, but it's like, it doesn't matter because it's sung to be misinterpreted. It's sung to be, like at a prom, or something like that, or like used at a wedding or something like that. It's kind of the same.
Yeah, it seems like between that and everything, it seems like he really blew his load with the Working Class stuff, because that was like his only experience he had. Yeah. Between Glory Days and My Hometown, which is basically like him singing about stuff that he remembered when he was like 8 years old, because that was the last time he was like a working man, I think.
Yeah. What you can never go back to these albums and really rediscover them, because they've just been played in the background too much. It's really hard. It's easy to like listen to them back and say, oh yeah, well this is better than I thought, but I don't think I ever really want to hear it. I don't think I want to sit down and say, you know what's really great is like Bruce Springsteen. That's what I want to say.
There's tons of people that would disagree with you though.
Well, you can find the good in it. You can definitely listen to this and say, oh, this is way better than I even remember it. But I don't like you. But then like once you stop focusing on it, it just blurs back up. Like once you're not actually trying really hard to look for the good in it, it just kind of blurs back up and becomes like, you know, tailgating like football stadium anthems and ballads. Like all the slow stuff he does, kind of like, I don't really care about that kind of rock or whatever. So I don't know. There's a lot to be said about him and his work. And I think he's cool. I think he's cool. I think it's cool that he brought, not that he just brought people with him, and that he brought guys from other bands and helped like give them stuff. He made really bizarre people in his band world famous icons. He made one of them got to be a soprano.
Yeah.
You know, like his guitarist is, you know, Syl from The Sopranos. And he looks like a Dick Tracy villain in that show. But he sells it. And he does a pretty good job with that. And then he got to be in another show where he just plays that character again because people liked it so much. And like, that's amazing. Like that guy would not have had that opportunity in a million years without that. He gets to have his own Sirius radio. There's at least three channels on Sirius XM that are just dedicated to different aspects of the Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. to me, this album in particular, though, I listened to it when I was a kid and I'm done. I'll never listen to Born in the USA again. It's got an ass in the cover though. So that's sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Like that's a move. Say, so, you know what? Like I'm just a normal skinny guy with a normal skinny man's ass, but that's going to be my feature on this album. We're going to do my ass this time around. So my final album, I don't even know how to do my introduction to this. So we're just going to go for it. A week or so ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, there was a comment on one of our SoundCloud links, which I almost never read. I don't read SoundCloud comments too much. We mostly get them from listener Travis. He'll comment on episodes and I'll go and look for those. I'll say, oh, Travis, what does he have to say about this episode? And I'll write him back. So a while back we did Trapped Under Ice. And I think I said something like, you know, I used to confuse Trapped Under Ice with Cold World because I didn't know either of them. They both have, you know, chilly names. They're both getting big around the same time from my perspective. They both had a little bit of like a hip hop influence that I thought, I mean, you know, whatever. And I just didn't know which was which. So I think I brought that up and said to me they were kind of interchangeable. And I think I also called them a merch band. Mm-hmm. And so I will say that at the time, I wasn't even... as much as I know things, I'm really out of touch with the living, breathing scene right now. I don't really go to shows. I don't know young people. I don't, like, participate. And didn't really even dawn on me that merch band is kind of a insult. Like, I should have known that. Obviously, I should have known that. But I just wasn't... I just said it because I was like, they're a band with a lot of merch. They're a merch band, right? That's kind of an insulting term. So I'll take that one. That's rude. And the drummer, Nick.
Yep.
Nick Wojavelli, Woj, or Nick something, W-O-J. Yep. He says, hey, I'm in the band Cold World, and your take on our merch game is wildly misguided. People went crazy for our merch because we barely made any. We were usually sold out before we even played and barely had more than two designs per show. Other bands basically aped our merch style and tried cashing in on it with web stores and stuff like that, which we never did. I don't remember what I said. So I don't know what that's in reference to. I'm pretty sure I just called them a merch band. I don't know if I went any further than that, but I will admit that I would have thought it was more what he's probably thinking, which is that they cashed in and that they were getting rich on their merch and stuff like that. And, you know, I read an article.
And just being a band that has, there's bands now that have walls and walls of designs. So
I thought they were the first band. Not the first band, but one of the early hardcore bands to just say, you know what, we're going to do different colorways of our shirts and make buku bucks.
Yeah.
But apparently they don't. You know, I actually read, I went back, I was kidding around with you that I found this article where it says he's killing the merch game. And I'm like, I just read that after he tells me he's not killing the merch game. But the article's pretty honest. He says, you know, we make these things in limited amounts and, you know, we sell them for like reasonable money and then we don't get anything out of it. Like yeah. other people resell it for $200 later and they make money. We don't make anything off of it. Like we just sell shirts and handfuls at the store and we make it limited because that's cool. Like we do, you know, so whatever. So he's on his own thing. I don't think he's hurting right now for any of this stuff. But I will say that, yes, I spoke out of turn and my apologies. And I have no bad blood. But
and now we're going to make fun of your record on the show. That's how we say sorry.
We say sorry by dissecting your work, yeah. your ideas, your thoughts, your heart, your dreams. So you put out an album, Nick, called Cold World, dedicated to the babies who came feet first. And this stuck out for me mainly because when it came out, I think that the people on our message board were not happy about it. Because is the title a reference to something? The title is a reference to like a...
It's a Wu-Tang Clan.
Wu-Tang. Song. Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought it was
a Ghostface. I think it's Ghostface. A Raekwon song.
So it's Raekwon.
It's Raekwon or Ghostface. It's on one of their records. I can't remember which one. Raekwon, I think.
That in particular seemed to make somebody angry. I don't remember who. And so I just keyed in on that. I was like, oh, man, here's this band. They're just making like wild hip-hop references in their music.
Yeah.
And that doesn't bother me, but it also, like, you know, if it's unearned and people weren't digging it, I just sort of note that in my brain. Like, oh, these guys are, you know. Some sort of hip hop posers. I don't think they are. It doesn't seem that way to me. But this album has a lot of stuff it maybe doesn't need. From my perspective, you know, like I listen to it now and I think, so I just to get it out of the way up front, I think the hardcore parts are mostly fine, like better than fine. Like this, you know, when I talked about Trapped Under Ice, I said that the guitars were too smooth and everything was kind of boring to me. Like to my ear, just not music wise, but just in terms of the sounds, it sounded kind of too smooth and too boring other than the vocals. This is the other way. Like they actually produced this really strangely. Yeah. Whoever did this did a really weird job. Billy from Biohazard. Okay. So Billy, yeah. Billy Bio.
Yeah.
Check out Billy Bio on Spotify right now, please. Yeah. that's something. So he did this and I gather the band's not a fan of it anymore.
I gather you are correct.
I think it's cool. I think that this is a really weird sound. You know, the guitars are, you can hear what's going on the guitars. That's pretty neat. The bass is so strange and distorted that it depends on what device you listen to it. Like if I listen to it in my car, I don't notice it, but if I listen to it on headphones, it actually sounds like a cello is playing, like an epic chord. It just sounds like, you know, it sounds like a boat, like a ship is playing a horn or something behind it. I think that that's cool. Drums are all right. I mean, I don't know what else is good or bad about it, but for the most part, I think that the production of this is interesting, and it kind of makes it for me. There's a lot of parts where they lapse into some almost Danzig singing. That's debatable. I don't really like Life of Agony. I don't really like Twitching Tongues. I don't really like the bands that do that kind of singing over hardcore. So it's not 100% my bag, but they do an okay job with it for the most part. I don't know who does those vocals or whatever. If they have a separate guy that just does the singing parts though, that's no good. You know, you remember when like all the like the like when the metalcore bands would have one guy who screamed and one guy who sang.
Yeah.
I don't personally dig that. Like I think you need to be able to carry both.
Or you can have a backup singer. It can't have a special solo job to right. do.
You can't. Yeah, like a stunt singer who has to come in and do the hard parts for you. I don't like that. But yeah, so the hardcore parts are cool, and that, you know, one of my favorite songs in the world, and one of the only Coalesce songs I really like is Harvest of Maturity. I know you like Coalesce a lot. Yeah. I don't mind them, but the one song that I actually really want to hear is Harvest of Maturity, which doesn't sound like much like a Coalesce song because it's groovy. It doesn't have all the weird off-time stuff and like the throwing your drums into the crowd stuff. It's just kind of a straightforward hardcore song. But it has one of those, you know, like the diggity-diggity parts. There's a lot of that on this album in the middle. Once they hit that stride, I'm on board. I love that riff. I'll write that. Give me a guitar. That's what I want to do. That's what my bands are going to do from now on. They go, that's all I want to do for the rest of my life. So they do a bunch of that, and it's really kind of out of place. It doesn't sound like other bands, I think. I mean, maybe I'm just way out of touch, but I don't think I hear a lot of the modern moshy bands that are doing stuff like that. Of course, this album's 10 years old now, so take the word modern however you want to take it. But I don't think a lot of stuff that was contemporary to them was doing that kind of that version of a groove. And that's my version of a groove. So that worked out pretty good. Didn't really check out the lyrics too deeply other than that. Yeah, this just kind of sounds like, you know, hard times stuff. I don't really.
Yep.
Doesn't do much for me. So, I mean, that's all fine. So then all that's left is the various influences, various other external influences that are taking place in this album, such as there's a lot of hip hop samples and, you know, like beat, like just like interludes of them playing, I don't know, a beat or a sample or like a record that they like. I could take or leave that, you know, like, does that bother you at all, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's terrible, but I just, that's probably my least favorite element of rap music is the skit. So yeah. I don't need to hear it in other genres of music.
I didn't really feel like to me, it didn't feel like a skit because it was at least music, but it felt like a skit because I didn't want it to be there. It was a superfluous thing from my ears.
I think it's novel to put that type of shit on a hardcore record because I don't think anybody has even attempted to do that.
No. So there's a couple of things that are, you know, that bear, you know, comment, and we'll get to we'll take the light one first and go to the heavier one from my perspective, at least. So they have a song called Wagwan. Wagwan. And, that is, you know, that's sort of that's a patois for what's going on basically. And indeed the song has dance hall parts, real, like reggae and dance hall vocals, you know, that they stand out like a sore thumb. It's kind of weird. It's not as like I've heard other stuff that does this and it does and it's really bad. Like one of my favorite bands is the Boss Tones. And one of their heaviest songs is a song called Isochar. It's really heavy, it's really fast. The, you know, the singer of the Boss Tones is one of the best screamers, or was one of the best screamers on earth. In the middle, they just stop and go into a part where there's like, you know, sort of mid-paced rock, and they let Dr. No from the Bad Brains just do dance hall or like reggae chatting. And it's awful. Doesn't need to be. It's a great song that just takes a break in the middle to have him do this echoey, like dub reggae thing. And I think this kind of felt like that, but done a little bit better. Like, I think it's mixed better. Like, they're more modern and they had better techniques or whatever. But I don't know if that really, I don't know if that really works. I don't know if you should really be calling a song Wagwan. I don't know if you should be putting out a dance hall song. My gut says no. I'm not the arbiter of that, and I'm not the guy who could tell you what's right or wrong about that, but I feel like I wouldn't have done it. That's territory. That's territory. I don't know if I would have gone there.
I think 10 years ago, 2008, is a simpler time.
Yeah.
I think people get... I personally don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I think people do get bent out of shape a lot easier now.
Yeah.
I just heard Maximum Rock and Roll had to change the cover of their fucking magazine because it was they put an all white cis male band on the cover of their magazine, and there was other bands that had features and interviews in it that weren't all white cis male, so people complained about that.
Yeah,
and that is wild to me. that people would complain about that. So yeah, I do think stuff like this, people would definitely complain about it now, but again, it's 10 years ago, simpler time. I don't fucking care.
Yeah, I think more critically, I want to know why they named the song Boom Bye Bye.
That's another hip hop reference.
So. That is a Buju Banton reference.
Well, that too, but I mean, it's, you know, I guess it's like.
Well, what's the hip hop? Okay, so that maybe you can save it. What's the hip hop reference?
I mean, it's basically that, but I think they say it in New Jack City too. They say Rockabye Baby in that. So I guess it is just Buju Banton then.
Buju Banton. That song is known for one reason. It's because it's about killing gay men. The song is. There's no subtlety. There's no. There's no interpretation. The song is literally like, gay men are gross and I need to shoot them with my shotgun. That's what Boom Bye Bye means. And it's known for that. Like, it used to get played on like Howard Stern or something like that all the time because it's like, that's the reference. That's the end. That's the beginning.
Oh, wait,
the
you know, I think Cypress Hill has a song called Boom Bye Bye too, actually.
Well, then they got to answer for it. Someone's got to tell me like why you guys keep talking about this song. That's not a good reference to make. That's a profoundly... I don't think the song has anything to do with it. Like, the lyrics and you read the lyrics, they don't... I just peeped into them. I was like, do they dissect that song? Because if you took that title and then wrote a song that kills that song, that would be interesting. If you're like, we're going to take on, like, a gross song that's about, you know, a crazy homophobic song, we're going to kill that and, like, give it and take its name. That's interesting. Doesn't seem like that's happening. And I don't know if someone in the band, is of an alternate sexual persuasion or whatever, where they can screw around with this concept. That's fine. That's up to them. Like, the whole thing is up to them, obviously. I think that that's kind of bizarre. I think that's a weird reference to be playing around with, because it's only one thing. It's not anything else. It's a very famous.
Yeah, I don't know.
Downplayed reggae song by a very famous man who is often not allowed to play it when he goes he goes out anymore. So yeah, like, some of the hip hop stuff on this is a little fishy. I'm soft on it though. Like, as much as I'm digging in and being kind of tough on a couple of these things. You and I, when we were in a metal band, we were just a serious metal band. I think we weren't jokey.
It was a little joke. I mean, well,
but we as people were jokey, and we would go on stage and be funny and this and that. But our music was not a joke.
No,
like, and we didn't have gags or funny samples or do anything presentationally to it. There was nothing about, like, you could just listen. If we just played you the MP3, it just sounds like metal. It just sounds heavy. That was the drill. But we would still do funny things, and we would still show up in, like, you know, weirdly disgusting, you know, like, urban clothing, like, intentionally scumbag. Like, I'm saying disgusting as, like, we showed up looking like scumbags sometimes, and like, wearing weird sneakers, and wearing, like, my cousin, who is actually a scumbag, gave me a bag of his clothes. So I had a giant powder blue velvet tracksuit that was four sizes too big for me, and sometimes I'd wear it. I thought that was funny. So, you know, when we opened a show, we just let my boo play a couple times on a boombox before we played once. So, you know, we were doing this. I guess we were kind of doing the same thing. So it's like, I can't really throw stones. Like, this was the same sense of humor we had. Yeah. So I can't get all that up in arms about it. But overall,
there's also, I've used rap lyrics in eviction songs too. So
true. And
I haven't rapped. Yeah. But I've used rap lyrics. Yeah.
Is the only time you've ever rapped in public when you guys did that Little John set?
Yeah, we covered Little John. That's the only time I rapped in public.
Yeah, so friends and band members did a Little John cover set. Who the fuck am I? Who am I to be out here telling anybody what to do with their time? You know, this is only a couple years before, and maybe even concurrent to this. I don't know. But I don't know. Like, as you know, to me, as long as there's, I think that the rock part, like the heavy part, is pretty pure. I mean, I know that there's some hip hop references in it. It doesn't sound like rap metal to me. I've read a couple of reviews since then that say that they sound like that they have like rap in the music and stuff. I don't hear any of that. It just sounds like hardcore to me. It sounds like hardcore metalcore, and I think that that's cool. That's fine. I actually liked. I don't know if I'm gonna listen to it a lot. I think I'm a little too old. I thought this was a cool record, other than, you know, having a couple of bones to pick with some of the weird stuff. What did you think of this record, Mike?
Yeah, much like Lana Del Rey and her two records, I was thinking this was their record previous to this. I mean, I listened to this one, but when it got brought up in my head, it was the one before this, which was basically a collection of 7 inches and shit like that, demos. And that had a song on it called Aya Likes. And when me and Sawyer, and I think it was me and Sawyer, I don't know if it was the time we went with Dylan, but basically when I lived with Sawyer, he had a car, and I think we drove cross country at least once in it. And it was still back when you had music on an iPod, and you would hook up like a fucking
the old thing. Days when you only had an iPod for
music. The old days. And I don't know if it was like one of those tape adapters or one of those kind of like chintzy adapters you got. And some of those had like quirks, and one of the quirks a lot of them had was that it would autoplay the first song on your iPod, whatever the the number one alphabetized song was. Which Aya Likes is 2 A's in a row, so it would be Cold World Aya Likes, and we drove cross country, so it was basically getting in and out of the car,
right?
You know, probably every 75
every pit
times.
Stop, every
yeah, getting in and out of the car for like 10 days straight, you know, at least ten times. So it's just like I heard that song like 100 times over a week, and it's one of those things where like I could kind of hum it in my head right now, but you know, if the second it comes on, it's just kind of like. That can be like some sleeper cell shit. Like if fucking Sawyer told me like some shit, like while we were listening to that every single time, I can probably murder somebody if that song just came on randomly. Yeah. And so it's just like, it has that reaction to me. So I was like pumped to talk about that record, but that's not this record. It's a record after this, which is their first full length. I didn't listen to this record as much. I think I gave it like a once over and I was like, okay, I'm good. This is definitely at a very weird time in my life where I wasn't really fucking with hardcore as a whole. But yeah, pretty much what Scott said. I would definitely classify the production on this as strange, mm-hmm. and I think it has some positives and some negatives. Just like Scott said, I think a big positive for me is I don't know if this was intentional by the band or if this was one of the little hiccups they had, but those vocals are really mixed down into the rest of the stuff. And I think Scott is a fan of that too, and so mm-hmm. am I. I don't think I don't think you should have double vocalists to do like one specific job. I don't think the vocalist needs to be up front all the time in a mix. I think it's
you got to bury that guy. You got to put him down there.
He's just like, I mean, he's maybe a little more important than a bassist. So like, it's just kind of like, you know, he's the guy who takes care of the money. That's it. But yeah, so I like that. I like it because you're not used to hearing music like that with a vocalist so mixed down into it. So that's cool. I like that. It sounds old, but like old in a way that it's not trying to ape something old. It's not like, oh, we need that Don Fury sound. This legitimately just sounds like old, like authentically old. And that's pretty cool. There's some pacing issues. Like there's some real awkward transitions where it sounds like when you play like an open world video game and it loads for a second too long and there's like that hiccup before you like move on. Like it just sounds like somebody forgot to like cut that little part out, and like some tempo sound kind of like weird, like that they don't sound like they're supposed to be that slow. But outside of that, the vocals, like the clean vocals that do come in, that's another part where it's just like, huh, they didn't even double these up. This is just like some guy just singing. There's no effects on them and make them wet or anything. They're just like, it's
just
a guy.
Just go for it, dude. Here's a mic.
So it's just like, it's interesting though. I mean, you know, it stands out, and the hip hop elements. I don't, like I said, I don't like skits. When I was younger, when I was 16, I would have probably been all over that. I would have fucking thought that was mind blowing that they did skits. But as I get older, man, I don't want anything to give me an excuse to fast forward. So stuff like that, I can't deal with. But I will say they have the title track dedicated to Baby's Feet First. They use the Roy Ayers sample, My Life, My Life, My Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes really well. I think that's like seamless. I think that's a fucking genius idea, and I think it works really well.
I really think the weird stuff, I mean, good or bad, I think the weird stuff fits. I think whoever is behind the wheels on the weird stuff, if it's Billy Bio, like more power to him. He's very good at integrating incorrect things into this for, because I think it sounds great. I think it's like, it all sounds like it's like super well like integrated into the music, good or bad. And I think that's something. It's like a textbook on how to do whatever this is, I guess.
Yeah, like I grew up was Connecticut, which Southern Connecticut, which is right near New York and right above Massachusetts, or right below Massachusetts. And for whatever reason, New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts had thriving rapcore scenes where, like, one of the first any kind of hardcore music bands I heard was Times Expired, which was a band from Providence, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's straight up, like, hardcore with a dude rapping over it. And that was, like, one of the first bands I heard. And I was like, well, that makes sense. Like, rap music's a popular music.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with rapcore, as it was known at the time, as kind of a normal thing. And I was just like, this is kind of what hardcore is. There's guys who rap for it. And it wasn't until very late. It wasn't until, you know, like five, six, like probably like 98, 97, where I was like, oh, you don't have to rap. And like, that's actually bad. That doesn't sound good when you do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. And it took me really late in life because it was just so thriving in my area. And you know, I will say, like Scott said, I think these guys get accused of being rapcore or something like that, and that is not the case. No. These guys are not rapcore. They have hip hop elements in some of their things, and like Scott said, I think it works well. I think that Royer sample is great. Like, there's just everything they do. It's not fucking, I don't know. It's not like, it's not wink wink. Like, hey, we love rap music. Like, right. It's not like that. It's kind of like the only time this Cold World will ever be compared to them. It's kind of like, was it Captain Jazz that mm-hmm. just put the jazz samples and all that shit in the middle of their stuff? Like, it's kind of like that, where it's just kind of like, yeah, here, you know, this is what we're into. This is obviously not a seminal album, I think, to, you know, maybe it is, I don't know. But, you know, if you're out there, if you're in a band and you listen to All Hills Filled and it's a band that people have heard of, and you want your record filled and we've never heard it, let us know and we'll check it out. Like I said, it has to be something people have heard of. It can't be your fucking demo for
your
local
band. It's gotta be great. It's gotta be really great.
It's gotta be great. It's gotta be something people know. Come on, man. Yeah. But anyways, yeah. But to sum up this record, it's good and I think the hip hop elements work. But you know, after this, they did release one more full length album, and that album does feature a lot of rappers. Oh!